So please join me in welcoming Mr. Robert Kennedy to talk about public health, personal freedom, and democracy.
Thank you, Gail. And everybody, can you hear me in the back? If you can raise your hand, if you can hear me. Okay, thank you very much. I want to start by apologizing for my voice. I used to have a very, very strong voice. And when I was 42 years old, I got an illness that is called spasmodic dystonia. And it makes my voice tremble like that. But I'm doing litigation under the racketeering statutes against all the vaccine companies right now. And when part of that litigation, part of writing the complaint, I had to go through the complete list of side effects that are listed in the 72 vaccines that are now mandated, vaccine doses that are now mandated for American children. And there's about 420 separate injuries that are listed on those, and I'd never ever put them all together in one place. I had to do that for the litigation. And when I was going through the flu vaccines, I noticed that spasmodic dystonia is one of the highest listed injuries in the flu vaccine. So I took the flu vaccine. I got this in 1996. And I took the flu during that part of my life. I was teaching at a law school, at Pace Law School in White Plains, New York. And the school infirmary, I just believed everything people told me about vaccines. My kids were all vaccine compliant. They all had all of their vaccines. I took the flu vaccine every year as was recommended. The school infirmary was right next to my office. So when they put up the flu sign every year, I would go in and get my vaccine. And it was that point that I got this illness. I do not know that this illness came from the vaccine. But I suspected it did. For the last 30 years, people have been asking me, you know, when I go to doctors to get it checked, I said, was there a trauma that occurred at that time in your life? And I've always said, you know, my life is a series of traumas. I don't know if there was anything. But their suspicion was something made this happen. So I don't know if it's from the vaccine or not, but it was an irony. I'm really happy to be here in Amish country. I grew up, I was born in Washington and spent the first 15 years of my life in Washington. And I came down here very, very, very often. My home is filled with Amish furniture, and I've always had a great admiration for the Amish culture and the Amish commitment. And I really wanted to come here. When I was asked to come here, it wasn't convenient for me to come here, but I really wanted to come here a number of reasons, but not so much to teach anybody anything, but to learn something, because I think we can all learn from the Amish. And I think one of the impulses behind their commitment is a universal impulse in all religions, which is how do we live our lives without allowing technology to become our masters? And I feel that we all need to struggle with that dilemma. And I feel that most of my career has been about trying to find the balance between how do we make sure that technology serves humanity and not become its servants? And I think more and more today, we are facing that dilemma where technology has now become our masters, and that our children are suffering in a very, very bad way. Our environment, Mother Earth, is suffering. And we need to do a reset, not the kind of reset they're talking about, about how I got into this racket of, you know, of being somebody who is questioning and helping inform other people about the vaccine ideology. I started my career working for commercial fishermen on the Hudson River, who a group of commercial fishermen who got together on the Hudson in 1966. I joined them in 1983. We have on the Hudson the oldest commercial fishery in North America. It's 350 years old. Many of the people that I spent my career working for came from families that have been fishing the river continuously since Dutch colonial times. It's a traditional gear fishery. They use the same fishing methods that were taught by the Algonquin Indians to the original Dutch settlers of New Amsterdam and then passed down through the generations. And one of the enclaves for the commercial fishery on the Hudson is a little village called Grotonville, New York, which is on the east bank of the river, 30 miles north of New York City. The people who lived there in 1966 were not your kind of prototypical affluent environmentalists. They were factory workers, carpenters, lathers, electricians. Half the people in Grotonville made their living, or at least some part of it, fishing or grabbing the Hudson. These were people who had little expectation that they would ever see Yosemite or Yellowstone or the national parks. For them, their environment was their backyard. It was the bathing beaches, the swimming holes of the Hudson River. It was their livelihood, their property values, their recreation. And in 1966, Penn Central Railroad began vomiting oil from a 4.5-foot pipe in the Croton Harmon rail yard. And the oil went up the river on the tides, it blackened the beaches. It made the shad taste of diesel, so they couldn't be sold at the Fulton Fish Market in New York City. And all of the people in Crotonville came together in a room that is about the size of this tent, maybe 3/4 of the size of this tent. It was the American Legion Hall in Crotonville, the Parkerville American Legion Hall. This was a very patriotic community. It was the only public building in the town. Crotonville had the highest mortality rate during World War II of any community in our country. Virtually the entire male population joined the Marines the day after Pearl Harbor. The people, almost all the original founders, board members, and officers of Riverkeeper, the first Riverkeeper, were former Marines. They were combat veterans from World War II in Korea and Vietnam. They came home and to try to do their livelihood, which is to fish the Hudson, and they found that they couldn't. The fisheries were closed. They couldn't sell their fish because of the diesel contamination. And all of the people came together, 300 men and women in a room, like I said, about this size, in March of 1966. They were angry. They had been to the government agencies that are supposed to protect Americans from pollution, to the Corps of Engineers, the Conservation Department, the Coast Guard. And they were given the bum's rush. The Corps of Engineers colonel, who they were begging to shut down the Penn Central pipe, which was his job, he told them, these are important people, in exasperation. Speaking of the Penn Central Board of Directors, he said, we can't treat them that way. In other words, we can't force them to comply with the law. And by this evening in March of 1966, virtually everybody had come to the conclusion in Grotonville, New York, the government was in cahoots with the polluters. And the only way that they were going to reclaim the river for themselves is if they confronted the polluters directly. And somebody suggested that they put a match to the oil slick coming out of the Penn Central pipe and burn up the pipe. Somebody else said they should roll a mattress up and jam it up the pipe and flood the rail yard with its own waste. Somebody else said that they should float a raft of dynamite into the intake of the Indian Point power plant, which at that time was killing 1 million fish a day on its intake screens and taking food off their family tables. And a guy stood up whose name was Robert Boyle. He was a combat veteran from Korea, Marine lieutenant. He was at that point the outdoor editor of Sports Illustrated magazine. He was there for 65 years. writing about fishing and hunting. And 2 years before, he'd written an article about angling in the Hudson for Sports Illustrated. And in researching that article, he had come across an ancient navigational statute called the 1888 Rivers and Harbors Act. And that statute said that it was illegal to pollute any waterway in the United States. You had to pay a big penalty if you got caught. But also, there was a bounty provision that said that anybody who turned the polluter got to keep half the fine. And he had sent that law to the libel lawyers at Time Magazine, which owns Sports Illustrated, and he said, is this still good law? And they wrote him a memo back saying, in 80 years, nobody's enforced it, but it's still on the books. And that evening, all the people in that room voted that they were going to start a new group called the Hudson River Fishermen's Association, and later became Riverkeeper. They were going to go out, track down, and prosecute every polluter on the Hudson. And 18 months later, they shut down the Penn Central pipe. They got to keep $2,000, which was a huge amount of money in Groveville, New York in 1968. They used that money to go after Sibagaigi, Tuck Tate, Standard Brands, American Cyanamid, the biggest corporations in America, and winning. In 1973, they collected the highest penalty in United States history against a corporate polluter. They got $200,000 against Anaconda Wire and Cable for dumping toxics in Hastings, New York. They used that money to build a boat. They began patrolling the river, tracking down polluters and suing them. And they hired me as an attorney in 1983. They hired a full-time riverkeeper the year before, and he was a former commercial fisherman. And we started suing polluters on the Hudson. Over the next 15 years, I sued over 500 polluters. We forced the polluters to spend over $5.5 billion remediating the Hudson. And today, the Hudson River is the richest waterway in the North Atlantic. It produces... It produces more pounds of fish per acre, more biomass per gallon than any other waterway in the Atlantic Ocean north of the equator. And it's the last major river system left that still has, on both sides of the Atlantic, that still has strong spawning stocks of all of its historical species of migratory fish. So it's a species warehouse. It's the last refuge for many of these animals that are going extinct elsewhere. It's kind of a Noah's Ark. And the miraculous resurrection of the Hudson inspired the creation of river keepers all over the world. So we now have 350 water keepers in 46 countries. Each one has a patrol boat. Each one patrols the waterway, tracks down polluters, and we litigate against them. We're now the biggest water protection group in the world. And in around 2005, I was representing about 20 or 30 different water keepers in North America and the states of the United States, the provinces of Canada, suing polluters, cement kilns, and coal-burning power plants for discharging mercury that was then getting into American fisheries. Oh, in 2003, 2 years before, the FDA published a report that said that every freshwater fish in America now has dangerous levels of mercury in its flesh. And American women, 1 in 6, have such high levels of mercury in their bodies, in their core blood, that their children will lose at least one IQ point. And we were litigating water keepers all over. We're litigating that most of that mercury was coming from burning coal. And we were litigating against the coal plants. And I was traveling across North America suing these polluters and giving speeches. And then I started noticing that in almost every talk I gave, there were groups of women who would come and sit in the front row. They would come early so they get the front row seats. And afterwards, they would come up and talk to me. And almost all of them with mothers of intellectually disabled children. And they each believed that their child had been injured by a vaccine, and specifically vaccines containing mercury. And they would say to me in a very respectful, but also kind of scolding way, that if you are really interested in mercury exposures to children, you need to look at vaccines. And this was something I did not want to do. I had spent a lot of my life working with kids on intellectual disabilities. It was part of my family DNA. My aunt Eunice Shriver founded Special Olympics. When I went to high school, I spent 200 hours in Wasaic Home for the Retarded up in the Hudson Valley, working with kids with intellectual disabilities. I had been a hugger and a coach at Special Olympics since I was 8 years old. It was something that was part of my family's history and DNA, but it was not what I wanted to do with my life. I wanted to protect clean water. And one of these women came to my home in Hyannisport, Massachusetts in the summer of 2005. She was a psychologist from Minnesota. She had a child who had been perfectly healthy, got a mercury vaccine, and became profoundly disabled, had severe autism. She had gotten a $20 million judgment from the vaccine court. Her name is Sarah Bridges. Her son's name is Porter Bridges, and he's still nonverbal today. And she came to my, she had her settlement. She did not want this to happen to other children. She drove all the way up to Hyannisport, Massachusetts, and she found my little bungalow there. And she took out of her trunk and put on the front porch of my house a pile about 18 inches thick, which were scientific studies showing that mercury and vaccines were causing severe intellectual disabilities in children. And she said to me, "I am not going to leave here till you read these." And I'm very accustomed to reading science. Part of my job as an environmental lawyer, I've brought hundreds and hundreds of lawsuits. Virtually all of them include scientific controversies. Each one of them, we have expert witnesses. And if I was not comfortable reading science and reading it critically, I would not be very good at my job. And so I started reading these studies. And before I was even 3 or 4 inches, I started reading the abstracts, which is the summary of the study on the front page. And before I was even more than 4 or 5 inches down in that pile, I recognized that there was a huge delta between what the public health agencies and the pharmaceutical industry was telling us about the safety of vaccines and what the actual science was saying. And so I started... I started doing what I always did when I found something that I didn't understand, something in science, which is I started calling the regulators. I started calling people like Anthony Fauci. I called Francis Collins. I called Marie McCormick, who was the head of the Institute of Medicine. I called Kathleen Stratton, who was the chief staffer at the Institute of Medicine. And I called Paul Offit, because the odd thing was all of these regulators could not answer my questions. Now, the big question I had for them was this. I had many, many questions, but here was the one that I think that stumped them the worst. How can CDC be telling women, recommending to women, that they not eat fish during pregnancy because of the mercury in the fish, and yet they're recommending flu shots for those same women that are loaded with hundreds of times of the mercury exposures that they're gonna get from the fish? And none of them had a good answer for me, and they all kept saying the same thing, you need to call Paul Offit. This was weird to me, because he's an industry guy. He's a vaccine maker. Why would the regulatory agencies be telling me they can't answer a question and that I need to speak to the vaccine industry? And when I called Paul Offit, he was very, very sweet to me on the phone. And he started out by saying that he was a huge admirer of my father. He said that he got into public health because he was inspired by my family. Oh, I was inclined to like the guy. But then I asked him that question. And he said, well, you see, Bobby, in a very patronizing way, the mercury, there's two kinds of mercury. There's a good kind and a bad kind. I've been suing people for mercury for many, many years. And I knew there was no good version of mercury. Mercury is 1,000 times more neurotoxic than lead. It is the most neurotoxic element that we know of in the universe that is not radioactive. I knew a lot about mercury. And he said, the reason the ethyl mercury in vaccines is safe is that it's excreted from your body very quickly. It doesn't reside in your body long enough to cause damage. Now, this is something that Eli Lilly, the pharmaceutical company, had been telling people for 60 years. There was no science to support it. But then in 2003, a CDC scientist did a study, his name was Picciero, in which he took blood from a child, from children who had been vaccinated with ethyl mercury, and the ethyl mercury disappeared from their blood within 1 week. And he took the same kids and fed them mercury tuna fish. That mercury, the methyl mercury in the tuna, he could find in their blood 54 days later. So this seemed to support this old lie that Eli Lilly had been telling for 60 years, that the mercury actually did leave your body quicker. He published that in Pediatrics, a big scientific journal. Immediately, a bunch of famous scientists wrote letters to Pediatrics and said, oh, what happened to the mercury? Because Picciero had looked for it. He had tried to find it in the sweat of the children, in their urine, in their feces. He couldn't find it anywhere, in their hair. He couldn't find what happened to it. And these scientists said, we believe it's still in those kids. And then NIH commissioned a study by a very famous scientist called Thomas Birbacher up in Washington State with about 10 other scientists from all over the world. They took macaque monkeys and they gave them tuna fish, half the monkeys tuna fish sandwiches, and half of them they gave vaccines. And then the same thing happened. The ones they gave the vaccines, the mercury disappeared from their blood in a week. 2 months later, it was still in the blood of the ones that they fed the tuna fish sandwiches. Then Birbacher sacrificed the monkeys, meaning he killed them and autopsied them. And what he found was that the mercury from the vaccines was all in their brains. The reason it was disappearing from their blood quickly is because that version of mercury crosses the blood-brain barrier very, very easily. And it was leaving the blood, but it was not leaving the body. It was going to the brains, and we now know that it stays. 27 years later, it is still in those brains, causing inflammation and causing a whole grim inventory of terrible diseases. And during that conversation with Offit, I said to him, Paul, how do you know that it leaves the blood? And he said, because there's a study by Piggiero. And I said, have you read the Burbacher study? Which was the study that said it's going into the brain. And there was dead silence on the phone. And at that moment, he knew, and I knew, and he knew that I knew, that I had caught him in a lie. And he said, well, you're right. But it's an entire mosaic of studies. And I said, can you give me a citation on any of them? And he said, I'll get back to you. And that's the last conversation I ever had with him. I'm hoping that soon I will be able to talk to him again in a deposition with sworn testimony. My friend, but let me just give you a little bit about the history of vaccines. And again, this is an area that I had to get dragged kicking and screaming into. When I was a kid, I got 3 vaccines. And I was fully compliant. I'm 66 years old. I was born 67. I was born in 1954. My kids, and I actually, Gail, said I had 6, but I now have 7 kids. And they were required to take 72 doses of 16 vaccines. And every child now in this country, if they comply with the CDC schedule, has to take 72 doses of 16 vaccines. Oh, the big change occurred in 1989. Why did it happen? Here's what happened. Around 1980, they added a new vaccine, which is called the DTP, the diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis vaccine. That vaccine, it turns out, was a very dangerous vaccine. And CDC and NIH recognized that it was doing brain damage. They thought it was doing brain damage to what they were telling the public. 1 in 1 million people are injured. But in their internal memos, they thought, you know, this may be injuring or killing 1 in 15,000 children, which is a lot. When you end up giving it to 86 million children, that's a huge number of kids that you're killing. Oh, they said, let's do a study. And they commissioned UCLA to do a study, and they paid them to find out. And the UCLA doctor who was in charge of that study quickly realized that the injury rate was not 1 in 15,000. It was 1 in every 300 kids were severely, permanently brain damaged or dead. And CDC did not want to tell the public. What it did is it secretly changed the dose to make it less toxic, but also far less effective. And then ultimately, 5-6 years later, they banned it, or they discontinued it in the United States. They also discontinued it in Europe. I'm going to tell you something about this vaccine. They discontinued it in Europe and the United States. But the vaccine companies still had their facilities, and they wanted to sell the vaccines. So WHO and now Bill Gates has arranged for this vaccine to be given to 161 million African children every year, and virtually all the children in India. It is the flagship vaccine for the WHO. It is the vaccine upon which they measure national compliance with their vaccine programs. So they may say to a country in Africa, if you want money for HIV, and if you want the money that we give you every year for your health ministries, you have to show us that 90% of your children are getting this vaccine, the DTP. Because of that, it is the most popular vaccine in the world. Bill Gates went to the Danish government in 2016 and said, I'm giving this to all these children in Africa. We're saving tens of millions of lives. And we want you to contribute to this program. The Danish government said, okay, show us the data that shows it's actually saving lives. Everybody believed it was saving lives, they just didn't know how many. And the Danish government said, let's do a study. So the Danish government partnered with two huge vaccine companies, the Staten Serum Institute of Denmark and Novo Nordisk. And so these were all pro-vaccine people. They hired a bunch of scientists who are famous pro-vaccine scientists, led by two men, Morgensen and Peter A. Abe, who's like a deity in African vaccine studies. They went to one country, Guinea-Bissau, in West Africa, that had been using this vaccine for 20 years. And the way that they gave that vaccine out was they gave the vaccine to every child at 3 months of age. They already had a long program where they weighed every child at 3 months of age in that country. And around 1980, they started giving them this DTP vaccine. But if the child, they noticed kids were getting sick if they were too young. So they said, if the child is not exactly 3 months when we visit his village, we'll give it to him, we'll delay it and give it to him at 6 months. As it turns out, half the children in the country between 2 months and 5 months of age were vaccinated and half were not over a 20-year period. So they had this amazing data. It was a natural experiment where they could compare outcomes in half the kids who were vaccinated and half were unvaccinated, perfect experiment. And they started looking at the data. They found that girls who got that vaccine were 10 times more likely to die than children who did not get it. I mean, that girls who got it were 10 times more likely to die than children who did not get it. The girls were not dying of diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis. They were dying of anemia, of pneumonia, upper respiratory infections, bilharzia, sepsis, dysentery. Nobody noticed for 20 years that it was only the vaccinated girls who were dying. And the vaccinated girls were protected against diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis. But in protecting them, it had ruined their immune systems so that they were vulnerable to the least scratch or other injury. Their whole immune system collapsed. And nobody noticed that for 20 years. And it's important that we understand that, because vaccines are immune. They're the only medication that never has to be safety tested against a placebo. And the problem with that is that you're not looking at health outcomes in vaccinated populations versus unvaccinated population. You're not able to say this vaccine is actually giving us healthier children. Those kind of studies are never done. And the one time that they did it, it was a catastrophe. So we've gone out, Children's Health Defense, and we found 71 studies that compared vaccinated population to unvaccinated population among 100,000 studies on the internet and the peer-reviewed on what they call PubMed, which is the archive for every peer-reviewed publication. We've been able to find 71, and we have those all posted on our website. And what you can see in every case, when you compare vaccinated populations to unvaccinated population, the vaccinated population are by far the sickest. They have diabetes, special education, rheumatoid arthritis, autism, ASD, all kinds of neurological injuries. Here's what happened next. There were so many kids injured by the DTP vaccine in our country before they pulled it, and lawyers were suing Wyeth, the company that was making it, and all the other drug companies. There's four of them, Wyeth, which is now Pfizer, Sanofi, Glaxo, and Merck. They were all getting sued. Wyeth, which had the biggest uptake on its product, said to Congress and to the Reagan administration, we are losing $20 in downstream liability for every $1 that we're making in sales. And the only, we are going to stop making vaccines altogether unless you give us complete immunity from liability. In 1986, Congress passed the Vaccine Act. Ronald Reagan signed it, Democrats and Republicans together. And they gave these companies complete immunity from liability. So today, if you are injured by a vaccine, no matter how negligent that company was, no matter how reckless they were, no matter how toxic the ingredient, no matter how grievous your injury, you cannot sue that company for liability. You can try to recover money from the federal government, and good luck with that. People who do that, you know, they get very, very small amounts, and it takes them years, and 65% of them get nothing. So what did that do to the industry? Well, industry. Well, we know what that's going to do to an industry. When you tell an industry, no matter how badly you behave, nobody can sue you, there's going to be no consequences. This industry, for drugs, for all drugs injure somebody. And the biggest cost to the pharmaceutical industry is downstream liabilities. And all of a sudden, Congress had said, you're not liable anymore. Well, not only do they now want to make vaccines, but they want to make a lot more of them, because it's now a gold mine for them. Not only that, but vaccines are the only medical product that does not have to be safety tested. Why is that? The reason for that is because it's an artifact of the CDC's legacy as the public health service, which was a military agency. CDC is still a quasi-military agency. That's why the upper echelon officers have military ranks, like Surgeon General, and they wear uniforms. And the vaccine program was conceived as a national security defense against biological attacks on our country. So they wanted to make sure that if the Russians came after us with anthrax or some other biological agent, that we could quickly formulate a new vaccine and deploy it to 200 million Americans with no regulatory impediments. And they said, if we call it a medicine, we're going to have to safety test it in placebo tests. And those take 5 years minimum, because a lot of the injuries that you get from medicines, including vaccines, you don't see them for 5 years. They're cancers, they're autoimmune diseases, they have long incubation periods, they have long diagnostic horizons, and they're invisible for the first 5 years. So, you know, if you give a kid a hepatitis B shot, he may not be diagnosed with a food allergy for 3 or 4 years. With autism, the average diagnosis for autism is 4.2 years. You're giving him that shot when he's 1 day old. So you're not going to see it. You will not see that effect if you don't have a long-term study. They didn't want to do the long-term studies because of the military threat. So they said, we won't call it medicine, we'll call it a biologic. And we will make a policy that biologics do not have to be safety tested. Oh, not one of the 72 vaccines is now mandated for our children has ever been safety tested in preclinical studies against a placebo, which means we have no idea what the risk profile is, which means that nobody can tell you with any kind of scientific certainty whether that product is going to cause more harms and deaths than it averts. Nobody can say that. Now, I've been saying this for many years. None of these products are safety tested. Tony Fauci has been saying that's misinformation. That's a lie. And Francis Collins, and all of them have been saying, oh, So I sued them and said, show me. Show me the state in 2018, Del Big Tree, me, and Aaron Siri. We sued them together and we said, you keep telling us that you got a study, show it to us. And on the courthouse steps, after a year of fighting us and in every way they could, they finally said, yeah, you're right. There are no safety studies. Oh, what happened? Because now we have a product. They don't have to safety test them, which saves them about $200 million. They don't have to pay downstream liabilities, which is the biggest cost. They also don't have to spend any money doing advertising or marketing. Why? Because the government is ordering you to take it. So all of the costs that a normal product would have to pay, they don't have to pay any of those. So this became a gold mine for them. And there was a gold rush after they passed the Vaccine Act in 1986 to add new vaccines to the schedule, including many vaccines that are utterly unnecessary. Listen, I grew up before the vaccine age, and I did not live in terror of rotavirus, you know, the next huge rotavirus epidemic. I never heard of rotavirus. Hepatitis B, you get from sharing needles as a drug addict, or from unprotected sex with a prostitute, or promiscuous gays. There was only three groups who were at risk of hepatitis B. Why do we give four hepatitis B shots to babies beginning on day one? Why? I'll tell you why. Here's why. Because CDC told Merck and Pfizer, we're going to recommend this for prostitutes and for gay males and drug addicts. And so you put a lot of money into a factory to make these hepatitis B shots. Well, it turns out the prostitutes and the drug addicts and the promiscuous gay males didn't want to buy the vaccine. And so Merck went back and Glaxo went back to the CDC and said, we can't sell any of these babies. And CDC, and we put all this money into our factory. CDC said, don't worry, we'll recommend it for babies. That's how it got on the schedule. And suddenly, SIDS began appearing. Crib deaths. I never heard of crib deaths when I was a kid. Babies didn't just die in their cribs. And, you know, they had to make up a new name, sudden infant death syndrome. It wasn't even in the books. And then others, hepatitis B, all of these rotavirus, many, many other diseases that are not casually contagious, and none of them are tested. So there was a gold rush at these, and we went from the three vaccines I had to over the next decade to the 72 vaccines now mandated for our children. And what happened to public health in this country? We have now a chronic disease epidemic. And what are those diseases? There's three categories. You have obesity, and there's three major categories, which we know is documented to come from vaccines. It comes from other things too, but it comes from vaccines, as does depression and anorexia and other food disorders. But three major categories, and that basically is all in a Yale study. The first is neurodevelopmental disorders. And if you were like me in the Amish, you guys probably don't even know what these diseases are. But if you live in the outside community, these are now part of our everyday lives. You cannot walk down the street. You cannot visit a classroom with or not kids with food allergies, with carrying EpiPens around, asthma inhalers. When I grew up, I had 11 brothers and sisters. I had about 77 first cousins. And I never heard of food allergies. And I didn't know, there was one kid in my Catholic grade school who had diabetes. And that was a huge deal. Everybody knew he had to give himself shots, and there was a lot of talk about it. Today, there's kids like that in every classroom. So if you're my age, you never saw these diseases. We never heard of autism. And it's not because autism was not diagnosed. It's because it wasn't around. And by the way, to this day, I have never met somebody my age who has full-blown autism, 66 years old. You do not see men my age walking around the mall, wearing diapers, a football helmet, headbanging, screaming, stimming, nonverbal, toe walking. I grew up on the spear tip of intellectual disabilities. I was involved with it as a kid. We never saw children with autism when I was a boy in Special Olympics. We prided ourselves on being able to take care of every kid, even people who were essentially vegetative. We would put the child on a special table and have them push a beanbag off the table, and everybody would cheer. But we could not have handle any child. We never saw a kid with full-blown autism. Children, we couldn't have handled them. Who would come in, who were screaming, who were biting, who had these terrible light and sound sensitivities and tactile sensitivities that you can't touch them. They don't like to be touched. They fight and are angry, and they're in pain all the time with these terrible gut aches. We never saw anybody like that. It happened beginning around 1989, with all of the vaccines. So you had the neurodevelopmental disorders, ADD, ADHD, speech delay, language delay, tics, Tourette syndrome, never heard of it. It's now all over. Narcolepsy, never heard of it as a kid. ASD and autism. The autism rates went from 1 in 10,000 in my generation, which it still is today, to 1 in every 22 boys today in the general population. And the New Jersey numbers came out, and Mary, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it went down to 1 in 12 in New Jersey, which is the first one to report. So the levels are still continuing to rise. And can you imagine this? If a foreign enemy did this to our country, disabled all these kids, what would we do to them? It's an act of war that these pharmaceutical companies are making on our country. And the allergic diseases, peanut allergies, food allergies, anaphylaxis, asthma, eczema. You know, my kids, like I said, I have 11 brothers and sisters, and none of them had these diseases. My kids have food allergies. I never knew they were vaccine related. But here's the thing. I have a son who has very, very healthy and, you know, an incredible kid, but he had anaphylactic food allergies from when he was born. He made 29 hospital visits, emergency room visits, before he was 2 years old. He was allergic to everything. So I helped found with David Koch, the oil guy, who's my sworn enemy. He had a kid, and I sued him many, many times. He had a kid who's exactly my son's age, who also has, you know, these anaphylaxis issues. Is there a? Oh, okay. And so we started something called the Food Allergy Initiative. It later became Food Allergy Network. And we raised a lot of money, tens of millions of dollars, to try to figure out a cure for food allergies. Now, the scientists that we were hiring and bringing to New York, they were not looking at what caused the food allergies. They were just saying, how do we cure it once you got it? So they would give food allergies to rats, and they would treat them with different treatments to see if they could find one that works. How do you give a food allergy to a rat? I'll tell you how. You give them the aluminum adjuvant from the hepatitis B vaccine with a peanut protein. And that rat will now have a permanent peanut allergy. You give him the aluminum adjuvant with a dairy protein and he'll have a dairy allergy. You give him the aluminum adjuvant with a latex protein and I'll have a latex allergy. We now know, and so you have these vaccines that not only had that aluminum adjuvant in them, but they had peanut oil excipients in them. So we gave a whole generation peanut allergies. We also know that the allergy occurs not just to other ingredients in the vaccine, but if you get that aluminum adjuvant and there's something in the ambient environment at that time, you can now have an allergy to that. So if you get that aluminum adjuvant, that hepatitis B vaccine, at a time when there's a timothy weed outbreak, that child may now have a permanent allergy to timothy weed. And there's a study by Mawson that shows that children who got that vaccine have 30 times the rate of allergic rhinitis as children who are unvaccinated. You wonder why all the Claritin is being sold and all these kids have allergies today. It comes from the aluminum in the vaccine. When they took the mercury out in 2003, they replaced it with aluminum and you had this explosion of allergies. And, you know, and aluminum also caused a lot of other brain injuries as well. So now you have the allergic disease, the neurological disease, and then you have the autoimmune diseases. That vaccine is intended to permanently alter your immune system by making it hyperactive against the antigen, against the viral particle that they're trying to target. As it turns out, if you overdo it, your immune system begins attacking your own body. That's what autoimmune disease is. That's what diabetes is. That's what rheumatoid arthritis is, what lupus is. And all these, there's over 100 now of these autoimmune diseases that are now disabling a generation of children. So when Tony Fauci came to NIH, well, let me put it this way. In 1940, he came in 68. In 1940, the level of chronic disease in Americans, all generations of Americans, was 6%. Tony Fauci came in 68. And the vaccine schedule began ramping up. By 86, the level of chronic disease had doubled to 11.8%. Today, as of 2006, which is the last time they did the survey, 54% of our children now have a chronic disease. And these diseases are all of the categories that I listed. Now, if you want to look, those diseases, which are the rheumatoid arthritis, the Tourette's, the tics, the ASD, the autism, all of these, they're all went epidemic beginning around 1989. And every one of those diseases is listed as a side effect on the manufacturer's inserts of those vaccines. So all the chronic diseases that went epidemic after 1989, or every one of them is listed as a vaccine side effect. These companies, which when I was a kid, these companies were making $187 million a year selling vaccines. Today, they're making $60 billion. But the big money is not from the vaccines, it's from selling the remedies for the chronic diseases that are coming from the vaccines. So if you look at the top 10 blockbuster drugs or any of those companies, those drugs are being sold to treat diseases that are listed on their insert, manufacturers insert as vaccine side effects. And by the way, federal law prohibits them from listing that disease on their insert unless the FDA believes that that disease, that the science supports the fact that that disease is being caused by their product. Oh, the $600 EpiPens that they're selling to my children, the albuterol inhalers, the Ritalin, the Adderall, the Concerta, a whole generation of kids is now addicted to amphetamines. You know, these neurodevelopmental disorders. The diseases that the anti-seizure medication, the diabetes medications, the arthritis medications, that's where the big cash is. Now, when I got, I am a measles survivor. It was extraordinary, lucky. Very, very lucky to have lived through that nightmare. Because we had to stay at home and watch TV the whole week with all of my brothers and sisters. It was horrible. And what is the cure? What is the cure for measles? Your measles is chicken soup and vitamin A. And neither of those things can be patented. But if you give one out of every 300 of those kids seizure disorders and one out of every 1,000 of them now have lifetime epilepsy, you now have permanent customers that are buying really high-priced drugs for life. And if you can spread those risks out among 84 million kids who are getting the vaccines, you've now created guaranteed profits for your company that are going to go on forever. And, you know, and that's why I say that, you know, it's so important for us to think more like the Amish think about how do we let technology become our masters. And how do we let people like Tony Fauci convince us that good health only comes in a syringe, and that, you know, that it has nothing to do with the way that we care for our bodies, and that we care, and that we care for our environment. You know, it has nothing to do. He's allowed these, his job at NIH that Congress appointed him. Let me just get a time check here. 5 minutes. Okay. Okay. Oh, his job at NIH is to figure out an NIAID, which is, he's supposed to figure out where are the allergic diseases coming from. That's in his title. Where are the chronic diseases coming from, the autoimmune diseases? Why are we having these epidemics? In the autism epidemic is 100 times worse than COVID. Because COVID is killing old people. At the end, the average age of death is 84 years old. But autism is destroying these young people who are supposed to be taking care of us when we get old. And now we're taking care of them, and it's one in every 22 boys. What is that gonna do to our future? What is it gonna do to our country? This is his job, to tell us where is it coming from. We know it's environmental. You don't get, genes do not cause epidemics. And by the way, you know, we did a film about mercury and vaccines. We actually came down to Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and we interviewed a doctor down here who ran a big, big clinic. And he said, yeah, I've never seen autism among the Amish. We don't have it at that point. He never had seen it. Yeah. And the CDC was so angry at that. They put out things and they said, it's because the Amish are genetically different than the rest of us. And, you know, the Amish are our control group. and they cannot stand it because and that's why they are, those agencies are going to do everything in their power to make the Amish vaccinate. Everything they can do. It is a thorn in their side. There is a group of people in this country who are not chronically ill and who people like myself can point to them and say, what about the Amish? Because what they're saying is, oh, we always had these diseases. Autism always affected one in every 22 boys. That's what they're telling us. And we have to be able, we can point to the Amish and say, it's not one in every 22 Amish boys. Why is that? And they say, well, it's because they're genetically different than we are. They're from a different planet than Earthlings. And so that's a caveat, a warning to all of you people who are Amish in here today, which is they are coming for you because they cannot stand the fact that you are healthy and that they have a control group that the rest of us can point to and say, you guys are doing something wrong to the government officials who are allowing this to happen to the United States of America, to our children and to our population. And Tony Fauci has led the way. His job is to figure out, how did this happen? How did every, beginning in 1989, every demographic in this country, from Cubans in Key Biscayne, Florida, to Inuit in Homer, Alaska, suddenly an autism epidemic hits them, and an epidemic that affects boys at a 5-to-1 rate to girls. There's only a certain, it has to be environmental. It's not genetic. It has to be an environmental toxin. Genes don't cause epidemics. They can provide a vulnerability, but you need an environmental toxin. And there's a very famous toxicologist called Phil Landrigan, and I've worked with him on many lawsuits. And he said, he did a list. I think there were 11 items on it. And he said, there's only 11 things this could be. It could be glyphosate pesticides. It has to be something that fits the timeline. It hits every demographic. It affects boys to a girl, boy-girl ratio. What kind of toxics could that be? He said, glyphosate pesticides from Roundup. It could be neonicotinoid pesticides. It could be PFOAs, which is a flame retardant that became ubiquitous on that timeline. It could be ultrasound, which I don't believe, but people, you know, that's one of the things that change. And it could be cell phones and a couple of other things. Boy, it's very easy once you get that list to figure out which one of it is. Or it could be the vaccines. Very, very easy. Any statistician will tell you, oh, here's how you do that. You go into the medical records, which we have in the HMOs, and you look, you know, every one of HMOs has all the vaccine records of every American, and they have all their insurance claims. It's very easy to go in there and do a cluster analysis and figure it out. Tony, if you try to do that, you're a scientist in this country, your career will be ruined. He controls 13 times the amount of money annual gifts as Bill Gates. And he has the capacity, the whole university system in this country is dependent on NIH funding. He has $7 billion. He gets $6.1 billion from the taxpayer, which he gives out to scientists all over the world. And then he has $1.6 from the military, which he's doing what they call dual-use experiments with, which is developing vaccines that are also weapons. That's why he was doing the gain-of-function stuff, because he had to do it to continue to qualify for that military money. And but his agency that he controls, I'm being told to shut up. $33 billion. Anyway, you get the picture. The Amish are doing it right. We're doing it wrong. Let's figure out how to figure out what they're doing right.
So we are going to move down to the homemakers tent for the Q&A part with Bob